and action.
Welcome to a special edition of the Art of the Cut podcast. Hi, my name is Derek Stettler, and I'm a writer, filmmaker, and host of a new filmmaking podcast called The Art of the Shot. The show features in-depth conversations with the filmmakers responsible for crafting the look of the most visually striking projects of our time. The Art of the Shot podcast launched in March, and there are 4 episodes so far. From Colin Anderson, SOC, the celebrated camera operator behind all of J.J. Abrams' films, to David Fincher's longtime cinematographer, Jeff Cronenweth, ASC. And if you're a fan of the work of acclaimed cinematographer Newton Thomas Siegel, ASC, you'll be pleased to hear that I recently interviewed him for the soon-to-be-released 5th episode, which touches upon his career, his visual approach, and his work on the new Spike Lee film, The Five Bloods. Editing is my first love when it comes to filmmaking. It's what ignited my passion for visual storytelling, and The Art of the Cut has long been one of my favorite podcasts. So I feel very honored to be here to introduce this episode. Listen on to hear Art of the Cut host Steve Holfish speaking with his friend, director of photography David Mullen, ASC. It's actually kind of funny, but David was the first DP I ever met. It was at a coffee shop shortly after I moved to Los Angeles at 21. I had connected with him because of his consistent presence on the cinematography.com and Roger Deakins forums, where he generously shares his truly deep technical and historical filmmaking knowledge with everyone. David's work includes shooting such films as Twin Falls, Idaho, Aquila and the Bee, The Astronaut Farmer, Jennifer's Body, and The Love Witch, as well as many TV series, including HBO's Big Love and Westworld, and the Amazon Prime series The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, for which he won an Emmy Award. Listen on to hear Steve's conversation with him, and if you'd like more conversations like this, please be sure to check out The Art of the Shot on your favorite podcast platform. There are links in this episode's description to make it easy to find. And now, please enjoy this conversation between Steve Holfish and director of photography David Mullen, ASC.
So let's start with color. A lot of that comes from production design. How do you work with or enhance that, or what are the considerations?
The basic lot we've created for the Alexa camera for the show is nothing unusual. It's very similar to a standard Rec 709 lot. It's not overly saturated or high contrast or anything like that. It's pretty straightforward just to make things look natural. So most of the color comes from the production line in the costume, or when I use colored lighting, like in nightclub scenes and things. Occasionally, because we do want to emphasize the color of the wardrobe, I'm cautious about when I use a non-white light on the costumes. I try not to make interiors overly warm, because that may shift the color of the wardrobe over, so the lighting tends to be just slightly warm for night interiors, for example. So I'm conscious of reproducing the colors of the costumes fairly accurately. Sometimes when we're in smoke sets or in overcast day weather, I'll ask the DIT to boost the color saturation to compensate. You know, if things get a little bland or washed out looking because of the weather on the SIG, you go up 10% or 5% on the saturation, and you'll make that adjustment and then add it to the CDL that goes off to the dailies colors. So it gets added to our dailies.
What are some of the difficulties for you as a cinematographer on lighting some of these complex blocking and camera choreography?
Obviously, the biggest problem is hiding the movie lights. It helps a lot to have the sets decorated with practical lamps that I can use when I just simply can't get my own lights and that there's some practical source on the performers, which generally helps a lot, but even that can be a problem sometimes because we were in a diner doing a 360-degree, a very tight space, and the diner had these low-hanging round globes over the tables, and we were circling someone at the counter, and as we crossed from the back side of the counter to the front side of the counter, the steadicam had to pass between the actor and the hanging globes on the ceiling, and these were not practicals that we added. They were part of the diner, and the diner had no dimmer system. It was just a non-op system. So there's this camera shadow as the steadicam crosses that point. And I tried to have him go through it as fast as possible. And in color correction, I tried to lighten the shadow that he created on the actors that moment he crossed. So it is fairly subtle. But so occasionally, lighting a scene with practicals actually can be a camera shadow problem if the practicals are level with the actors' faces and the camera's having to cut between the source and the actors. I mean, if it's on stage, I can put the practical on a dimmer and dim it out when it goes off camera and things like that to try to avoid the camera shadowing issue. But as much as possible, I try to get the sets lit, mostly with practicals, because I don't know where the camera is going to be looking. And that sort of leaves mostly above the frame line for soft lighting, like light mats. Occasionally, I will do eye-level lights, but they have to be handheld. I have an electrician actually holding the light mat and dimming it out and ducking behind a wall or something to get out of the way of the camera. And I just can't kind of do it from all over it.
I'm not usually a set person, but is it Hollywooding a light when you do that, when you're kind of carrying it or moving it?
When you're hand-holding the light, we call it Hollywooding. You know, Hollywooding, it basically just means manually moving it out of the way or into the shot, or rather than having it fixed onto the stand. So yes, it's just a general term for a handheld light. Anything that you handhold and move out of the way, like could be a bounce card, you know, or something, or even a piece of furniture, you may say that, well, I'm just going to Hollywood that table out of the way of the steady cam, you know, or something like that.
Most editors or filmmakers in general consider themselves to be storytellers. Can you think of a specific examples of how you're telling the story with the quality of the color or the lighting or your choices of lenses or composition?
Well, I think every setup, it's about bringing out the humor of the sequence, the energy of the actors. That's the main goal, is to support the story in terms of the pace and energy and humor of the scene. Occasionally, of course, you're also trying to make a story point with the composition, either subtly or more dramatically. It comes up sometimes with depth of field and focus issues. For example, I had a scene where Rose, the mother, is sitting in the living room by a window trying to relax and have a cup of tea when Joel's mother comes in and starts talking to her and then moves outside into the street and starts yelling at the neighbors. And I decided to shoot that with a deep stop so that you would frame both Rose in the foreground inside and Shirley, the mother-in-law, outside in the street, all in focus together. So the humor of Shirley yelling in the background and Rose reacting in the foreground was clearly set up in the composition. The same thing we've seen before. We had a shot where, again, Rose and Abe were in their cabin in the Catskills talking about their son, who they just found out was in the CIA. And the son is outside in the field playing football with his friends just outside the window. And while I could have put on normal level of ND and shot it at a 2.8 or 4, I decided to shoot it at an F11 so that as they're talking in the foreground, who they're talking about is clearly visible in the background. And the irony comes from them saying things like, do you think he's killed people? And in the background, he's tossing a football. So the kind of innocence of him playing in the background is juxtaposed by them in the foreground talking. So those are all kind of story-driven decisions, where to hold focus, when to do a deep focus shot, things like that.
Can you think of a composition example of that beyond the football one? Sounds like, obviously, he's in the shot.
I mean, a lot of that is just the blocking, because this is from moving the camera so much, it's not, we don't have often a static frame where everything's sort of told in one static shot, although sometimes we do that. It's more part of, I think, in Dan Caldino's episodes, you'll have a funny shot, which is a static wide shot composition where you see everything in the frame happening all at once. When they all move into the Catskills, the cabin, in his episode last season, the season before, and the this season, there's a scene where Abe and Rose are in their bedroom, two scenes where they're just trying to escape the noise of the house, and the maid, Zelda, comes in and says, can I join you? And she sits down in the shot, so it's just sort of a tableau shot with Rose in the foreground, Abe in the far background, and Zelda in the middle. It's very humorous because they're all kind of deadpan, and the shot's very deadpan.
I remember a shot, I think it was in the final episode of the season, with Abe and Rose having dinner in a kitchen, in their kitchen, and the maids in the background trying to like get out of there or leave, and just having it was a wonderful composition with a lot of headroom that seemed like it was to show kind of the location they were in. Or
we tend to have a generous headroom. I think it's part of the classical framing of the show, but also Jim McConkie, our operator, just loves to get practical lamps and things at the top of the frame. He likes to keep things in the frame. So often I know if I could take one, he's tilt it up a little bit more because he said, oh, there's a lovely ceiling fan back there. And then, you know, third take, he'll be tilted even a little more. He goes, oh, there's a great little thing that's running across the ceiling. I was thought it would be nice to hold that in. And at some point, I have to keep him from tilting up further because he's trying to bring more interesting sort of elements around the edges of the frame. It happened in the Catskills, where we had this great rec room set that had wooden slatted ceiling with ceiling fans and hanging lamps, and it was very hard not to keep framing the stuff in because it was just sort of dangling at the top of the frame line. So you're constantly deciding that it's either got to go in or out, you know, but it was just hard to decide. But so we tend to be sort of classical in the framing, and also not moving the camera too unmotivated unless it's to follow an actor. So if we're doing a static shot in the kitchen, rather than tilting up and down with someone who's standing up and down, we'll just frame looser so that we can hold the headroom when someone stands up again, things like that. It's just the movement's got to be more about where the actors are going in the space rather than the camera adjusting. And also, we tend not to do close-ups, so our shots are looser in general, so it's a caution about holding what we can in the frame, basically.
Totally makes
sort
sense.
Of the, almost the tension, though, in the framing is that we're, Amy doesn't like close-ups, so our close-ups are like waist up or navel up at the tightest. You don't want to get too loose on everything because you want to see the actors performing. You need to see the emotion of the scene. So it's always this tension of, have we backed up too much? And if we push in closer, then we don't have enough room for the actors to move on the edge of the frame. And so we're always playing that sort of edge on not getting too loose, but not getting too tight. And it's even harder when we're moving the camera on the steady cam, because in a tight space, there's moments where it's very hard to not pass close to a foreground actor, because there's not enough room to back up the camera and circle them at a bigger distance, which is one of the reasons we tend to shoot on wider angle lenses on the show. It's partly because the intimacy of being close to the actors with the camera, and Jim McConkey, our operator, loves wider angle lenses, but it's really mostly just practical reasons that we don't tend to pull walls because we do so many 360s. And so with furniture and in small spaces, we have to get wide angle just to stay loose enough on the actors, but they don't want distortion on the actors. Sometimes later I'll get notes from Daly saying, why is Susie's hand so large in the foreground in the shot? Oh, well, it's because we shot her with a 27 on the table because we're trying to be inside the foreground person. But when she leaned forward, suddenly her hand got very large in frame because of the wider angle lens. So they don't want the distortion to the wide angle lens. They just want the looser size. And often they also don't want over the shoulders. They'd rather have clean singles, which tends to push us closer and wider to be inside the foreground person when we go into coverage without getting too distorted. We just don't want it to get cartoonish with the lenses.
I know there are some DPs that, I don't know if they're rare or not, but they would much rather be operating. Where do you stand on preferring to have your attention elsewhere or operating, or how that relationship works with your operator?
I enjoy working with Jim, and it's good to have such a talented operator on the show. I personally mostly want to concentrate on lighting and the storytelling elements and leave the physical operating to someone who's more talented at it than I am. Also, it's just always good to have a second pair of eyes, or even a third pair. I've got my camera assistant, Anthony Capello. Now I've got the DIT myself. So it's good to have people looking out for things in the frame. And so I like working with an operator, especially in a show like this. It's just, most of it's a steady cam or a movie or Technicrane, and I don't have that level of skills to do it myself.
Can you make determinations about lens choices as you're reading a script, or do you need to be on set or location for that decision to be made?
You have to sort of know what your ground plan is for lenses before you go into a shop, because you got to order them, and you're not going to just order every lens ever made. and if you've got two camera packages, you try to double up on what you can, but that's really forcing to think of what your most commonly used lenses are going to be, because you may decide you need 2.24s or 2.50s or something like that. So you have to have an idea up front, but within the first few days of shooting anything, you start to get a sense of the true style of the show, and that gives you a clear idea what lenses you're going to be using the most often. When we look at locations, we'll use an Artemis finder, a lens finder. Over, you know, three seasons, our lens choices have gotten whittled down to the most common choices. We use a 24, mostly for masters and Steadicam. When we can do it on a 27, we will, just so that we don't get too wide angle. We often find ourselves switching back and forth from the 27, 24, trying to decide which we like more. We have a 30 now because sometimes the 30 is just the perfect focal length. It's not too wide angle, not too telephoto. Occasionally you do get a scene or a location, a space where you imagine it would be more attractive or interesting on a longer lens. I had a scene where Benjamin drives Midge back to New York City from the Catskills and pulls up in front of their townhouse, and it's this big, beautiful car on the tree-lined street, and I just imagined the master being like on a 50 mil or a 75 just to get the compression of the cars stacked up along the street and the big trees overhanging the street. It just seemed more lyrical than a wide-angle shot where you'd have a giant grill of a car in the foreground. I didn't want the big nose of this giant, you know, Cadillac in the front of the lens. I wanted a more compressed shot where you see the front of the car, but it's not giant, and you see them get out of the car on each side of the car in a frame kind of in the 50-50. So a longer lens with a flattening effect was more lyrical and attractive for that sequence.
I want to talk about skill development for young cinematographers. One of the things I've known about you for a long time is that you're always image making.
Well, it's partly my hobby, I think. It keeps my mind active. I just like taking pictures. You just see the world as a lens does, kind of thing, and I like capturing things. Some of it's like a sketchbook, you know. You see something quirky or interesting and you just want to take a picture of it. It doesn't always reference back to my cinematography. It's some of it's just for my own personal satisfaction. But I love photography as an art form, and whenever I'm in New York, I'm constantly going to galleries and museums to look at exhibits. And then I go out on the streets and I sometimes experiment with styles, you know, like, oh, I just saw this documentary on Jay Mizell, and now I'm trying to shoot sweet things like Jay Mizell or Robert Frank, or I've seen some autochromes, and now I'm trying to replicate the look of an autochrome or an 8x10 landscape by, you know, Sally Mann or something like that. I like experimenting. Hopefully someday it may reflect back on my own work as a cinematographer. You never know. I think it's just part of becoming literate and telling stories through images. You know, it's like reading books or seeing movies. You're just adding to your sort of literacy.
I love the idea you mentioned, the autochromes that you were trying to replicate. When you do that and you're thinking through replicating that look, how useful is it for you to be able to verbalize what you're doing? Like, could you tell me what the look of an autochrome is?
You know, I get that question a lot from students often as they say, I want my movie to look like an old movie, or I want my movie to look like it was made in the 70s, or I want it to look like The Graduate. And I tell them that you have to break it down into specifics, because one thing, I don't know what version of The Graduate they saw they're referring to. They could be talking about a DVD NTSC copy, or they maybe saw an old print in a revival house, or maybe they saw a new digital projected version. They're all going to be different. So it's kind of useless just to be generic about it. You have to get down into the specifics of color, contrast, grain, depth of field, sharpness, just stylistic elements. Maybe you're responding more to production design or lighting than any technical thing with the camera. Everyone responds to an old image differently, and the things that stick out to them are different. So I think it's important as a student to break everything down into its particulars. But the caveat being that there are intangibles too that you have to be aware of. You know, they're talking about the feeling of old movies, you're often also referring to memory. I remember seeing X movie when I was a kid. Now you're dealing with the vague area of the gut feeling of what things used to look like. So there's nothing wrong with that as an artist, but you have to recognize that you do get, after you've broken things down to the technical elements, you do get into intangible areas which are not easily recreatable. Again, most people see autochromes in books. You know, they're meant to be seen, they're kind of backlit glass photos, you know, the starches are sort of glued or affixed to this piece of glass, and when you shine light behind it, it's sort of like a glass slide. Now those are re-photographs of books and things, but it's a different experience seeing an autochrome person than in a book. But also, because autochromes are sort of handmade, they vary a lot between them. You look at a book of autochromes, and some of them are faded, and some of them are saturated, and some of them are bluish, and some of them are orangish. And so you've got a lot of variations in the process. They're pretty random at times, the amount of grain, and depends on if they're 8 by 10 or 4 by 5 or something. And then the quality of the lenses, you know, this is all turn of the century, 1920s, whatever, era photography. So the lenses used back then have an effect on the look of the image. A lot of them are large format plate photography, so they have a certain look from that. So I think you do have to be able to analyze an image and sort of see it in its technical components, but also realize there's a point where you can't reproduce everything exactly unless you're a scientist and you have access to the highest tech, you know, color correction computers and stuff. So, but if you're just sort of monkeying around with your own cameras and lenses and by your own Photoshop, you just have to recognize that you're only creating your own personal approximation of something and you're not actually recreating it exactly.
Let's talk a little bit about that, kind of continuing this discussion of being able to verbalize or understand the image that you're trying to recreate possibly. I've seen a number of things from you on social media where you talk about, oh, look at this old movie. Here's what I notice, the hard rim light or whatever it is. What are some of the ways that things that young cinematographers need to be able to do to kind of reverse engineer an image they've seen? Like if they're watching The Graduate, well, how do you recreate that look? What are you looking at? If you're a cinematographer and you're saying, okay, here's this still that I'm looking at, what are you doing to be able to figure out what makes that look the way it does?
You could do this without knowing how the film is shot, you know, just doing all your own kind of modern tools and techniques and just sort of guessing or just replicating it from a purely technical analysis of how hard or sharp or the color of a light. But it's useful for me to know how the film was made originally, just to have a basis to why does this set look a certain way, or this location, you know, like in The Graduate, why is the background view out the window of a certain brightness, why does it get to feel a certain way? So it's useful to know that, you know, the speed of the film stock was 50 ASA, let's say, and they're likely to push it or rate it at 100 ASA, that the lenses, you know, these Panavision zoom lenses, really a 5.6 or 4.5.6 split lens, so you're going to get that kind of depth of field, you know, and but you're shooting these lenses wide open, so you may have different sharpness fall off. And you know what the sort of lighting instruments they might have had, you know, tungsten Fresnel lights inside, maybe the arcs outside the windows, or maybe they gelled the windows to tungsten. And once you start to know that the faces are probably lit with tungsten Fresnels versus open face bounced off cards or whatever you've learned or can figure out, that's a good grounding to start to try to replicate it yourself, whether or not you end up doing using modern lights and doing your own take on it, because it's not 100% necessary to use old tools to recreate an old look. It's good to know what they had to work with. And you get a sense of, you know, once you know the film stock was 50 ASA or 100 ASA, you get a sense of how bright the light levels must have been just to shoot it at 2.8 or 4. And that will affect the ambient levels in the room. It'll affect the contrast. You know, you will have to use more artificial fill light because you're key light levels are so high that there's no natural ambient fill. You have to sort of provide it. And that affects the style and things. And if you're doing it yourself in a short film or practicing it, I think you'll learn very quickly some of these issues. The fact that I came out of film and 16mm and Super 8 reversal before film school, and then I started shooting 16 in film school, and my first few features or even cut on a flatbed, so I actually had film dailies for my first two features. You learn a lot by shooting and printing and projecting these film images, even if later you no longer are printing things, you're doing it all digitally. Having an understanding of the positive, negative, you know, system and how print stocks affect the way a negative is reproduced, it's all useful information. and skill to have.
If Marvelous Mrs. Maisel was shot on film and projected, what negative stock and print stock would you want?
It's a good question, because we shoot on the Alexa, and I mostly shoot at 500 PSA on the Alexa. So obviously, if I didn't want to change my lighting package and style of the way the sets are rigged, then I would use 5219 now. That's the only 500 each stock.
I know that the print stock is also really important. What would be considerations for choosing a print stock?
Well, it's only now just Vision, so not really any choices, but back then when there was Vision Premiere, that would have been an ideal stock for this show. And then I might have to light a little more fill to compensate for the contrast, but that was a beautiful print stock.
When you have a scene that is very emotional, that you know is going to be difficult for the actor to do over and over again, or even to do because of just emotion, does that play into your choices of setups or lenses or angles or anything?
Well, I think that's most of the director's call about the angle, but I mainly just try to avoid having to do any adjusting of the lights between setups and between coverage, because the director will want to go again and again and again, and then maybe move in closer right away, so there's not going to be time to fix anything. So I think it's very important at that point to design the lighting of the master so that it doesn't need changing in coverage. It's not always possible, but I try to think of it in those terms. What's the least amount of intrusion I can put into this set once I'm done, you know. Once I've finished lighting, I just pretty much have to leave it to the actors and the director. I think that's the main thing. You know, you can get into a shot design that may be so complex that it's distracting for the actor to remember how many positions they have to move or where they have to adjust themselves. That's more a conversation between me and the camera operator. You know, we'll notice there's a certain problem with getting tired or headroom problems, and the operator will say, well, they're like a foot past their mark, or I've got this thing in the way and I can't back up any further. And I'm like, well, we're at a point where we can't, you know, give the actor notes because they're in the middle of their emotional performance, and I don't want to try to tweak their positions because it's a trouble for the camera. So we'll just try to make it work, you know. Maybe move some furniture out of the way so you can back up another inch, or just live with it. And if the director seems fine with it on the monitor, then you can just, you know, go with it. But it's not going to be a perfect frame, but it's not worth, you know, throwing the actor off by having to make adjustments at that point.
What was that transition like from film to digital, and when did you finally feel comfortable that the image wasn't being compromised?
Basically, by 2010, when the Alexa came out, it seemed that digital was technically at least on par with 35mm, to the point where you didn't feel like it was a disappointment to shoot digital. It wasn't the same thing, of course, but it was not a compromise, so to speak. Before that, you had decent cameras like the Panavision Genesis, which was pretty good, but, you know, it was different enough from film that there were certain things you still preferred about the film, and it's particularly dynamic range. It's very hard to beat the overexposure attitude of color negative. I think the Alexa comes the closest. You know, when I started out in film, the problem wasn't, there was only film really in the 90s in features. I only did one Super 16 film, and everything else was 35mm. The biggest issue was after film dailies went away, was that low budget films just had VHS dailies, and those were just terrible. And then after a few years, VHS dailies became DVD dailies, which were slightly better. But you really didn't have HD dailies. They were affordable, not until the 2000s. And even today, still, with film dailies, they're probably going to be now streaming, or they're going to be on Pix or something. And you got issues with streaming, those sort of things, watching dailies on an iPad. It's just not the same thing. I prefer both film and digital, as we get still frames from the dailies. With Maisel, we get 3K. We shoot 3.2K, so I get 3.2K stills off the dailies files that get mailed to me in the morning.
And I know what the show looked like because I saw it on the HD monitor, but it's nice to collect these stills and have them as reference, and you can really spend your time, you know, zooming in and studying the still. But if I was shooting film, I would get HD frame grabs, and I prefer those some ways than the video dailies because at least the still frame would be much less compressed, so I could actually see sharpness issues. When I played it in motion, usually the compressed stream and dailies, and it's very hard to judge whether things are sharp or not.
Do you think it's important that I be watching dailies and editing with a proper LUTed, calibrated image? Do you think it could alter my perception of how I'm cutting to not be looking at the image the same way you were looking at it?
I think it's important that the editor is looking at something pretty close to where it should look. I think if there was a problem with the shot, you know, if they're editing log dailies, for example, I don't know why they would, let's say they were just looking at a washed out log image, it might affect whether they're using a shot that is actually usable. It may be an underexposed shot that, you know, once you put the Rexilar 9 light on too, it's much too dark to use, and once you lifted it, it would be much too noisy to use. So it's important to get something close to accurate in the editing room, so they're using usable shots essentially. And if there's some weird color mismatching, everyone should sort of know that's going to be an issue, so that often the editor will send notes to me or send notes to the post supervisor saying, you know, there's something wrong with this shot here. Mostly it's focus issues. You get, you know, notes about, oh, this take was a little bit soft. And I think it's important that editors work at enough resolution that they can judge the sharpness of the shot, so they don't, you know, if they had to choose between two takes and one was off, you know, but they can't tell because they're working from such a compressed file, that could be a problem when there was a sharper take that was available. It could be there wasn't enough performance difference. I think working with good dailies and having a large 3D monitor in the editing room is important. It's important for the director and important for the editor in the editing room.
I've experienced some level of temp love on the way an image looks in editing, even if it's not as the DP wanted it to look. Once the director is sat with it for 6 months in an editing room, they're like, oh, this is what the movie looks like.
Yeah, it's a real problem. And that's why I think dailies have to be pretty accurate, because you could fall in love with or get used to the way it looks in dailies. I think it's particularly true if you're planning any post effect, like diffusion in post. A lot of people say, well, you know, you can save all the diffusion effects to post. There's no reason to use a diffusion filter on the camera. And I'm thinking, like, well, if they look at a completely sharp image for 3 months in an editing room, they're not going to want to apply the diffusion filter after that when they go into the final color correction, because they've been looking at a sharp image for too long. I think something like a diffusion effect has to be in dailies. And it's pretty hard to do it, you know, in dailies colorist add. And that's why I'd rather do it in camera. You know, day for night, other things like that too can be an issue if they're not accurate.
What kind of collaboration do you do with or have with your colorist before or after the shoot?
Well, to start the show, I work with the colorist group, the Lutfers monitors on the set with the DIT and myself and the dailies colorist, or actually the final colorist. We all work together to create a LUT. I shoot tests and pre-production, and I color correct them in the post house, and then we create our LUT that we're going to use in the camera and in the monitors. The colorist and I will basically set looks for scenes. If I'm not available to color correct from the start, you know, I might go in before they start and just set a look for the first frame of every scene, and then I'll come back later. But on a show like Maisel, we've had the same colorist pilot, so he knows the look of the show, and he, you know, for all three seasons, he basically color corrects the episode first, and then I see his correction at Light Iron, and I give him my notes, and he makes adjustments, and then he creates a second version, and that's what the director sees when we go to the mix stages, and they'll preview my correction with the colorist version, and then they make a few more adjustments after that. But I pretty much leave it up to Steve Bodnar, our colorist, to, you know, set the look of the episode, because he's done every episode, so he knows what it is. And it's not, you know, a big difference between dailies and the final look. I try to get it pretty close on set. And that's one of the advantages of digital. You know, with film, there can be a lot more variation from dailies to final correction.
I don't know too much about the specifics of the digital cameras, but I do know that back in the HD and even SD days, choosing which camera you wanted to shoot with was very similar to choosing a film stock. Would you choose a specific camera, a Red or Arri or something else, because of the look that it was going to grant you, and what would that be?
Well, it was much more important in the days of Rec 709 when you were baking in the color gamma and gamut into the final image, basically coloring in camera. So you were giving yourself much less flexibility in post. But once log and raw recording came along, there you can match cameras a lot easier now that you, especially if you use something like Asus and you're really matching a range of cameras on the same show. I haven't used Asus myself because most of what I do is single camera. We're not trying to mix in three or four types of camera, and we're not mixing in a lot of visual effects. But today, you know, you tend to judge cameras a little more like by speed, sensitivity, noise, dynamic range. Color is generally something you can create in post working from the log data. Although there are differences still between the cameras, it's something you can test for. I think you're more likely to pick a camera, you know, beyond budget reasons, by the resolution, the dynamic range, the size of the sensor, which will affect the lenses, depth of field, maybe the workflow. You know, the Alexa and Arri cameras in general have this amazing open exposure range that the other cameras don't quite have. It's not just the dynamic range, but it's how they've engineered their log version to roll off the clip point more gently. And that's something you always see when you do comparison tests. It's where the point where something burns out to white is where Alexas tend to be the most organic looking. Although the last generation of other cameras have gotten pretty close. You would tend to pick a camera today based on, do you have to deliver a 4K version? Do you want to use a large format sensor? What sort of size and weight of the body is like? Are you going to use it on a Mophie or Steadicam a lot, or, you know, in a drone? It's the sort of physical factors will be an issue too. But the look is a little less baked in than it used to be because we have more access to the sensor data than we used to before. We were dealing with a processed image that had broadcast gamma baked into the recording.
How do you keep growing as a cinematographer? What do you do to continue to get better?
I think you try to educate yourself not only on current trends and technologies and stay up to date, but what people are shooting, you know, what's out there. You try to keep an eye on what's playing on streaming and in theaters. But also, personally, I keep going back to the well. I keep looking at all of these classic movies and also the movies I saw as a college student that inspired me to go into cinematography. I just want to go back to the things that attracted me originally and try to get re-inspired again by those sort of things. I tend to take a holistic view of cinematography. Like, I look at all 100 plus years of it and try to find elements from every decade that I would like to see come back or see if I can find a way to sneak some element of that back into something rather than be a completely current trends and fad follower. Try to be a little more general about that. But so I think just watching movies and reading is about them and is important. Talking to your fellow cinematographers and talking to the vendors and seeing what's going on, just being up to date with everything. But you have to really constantly go back to the emotional things that exist about image making, and whether that you get that from watching a classic movie or going to an art gallery or a photo gallery or going on Instagram and looking at new images created by new artists. Whatever it is that gets you excited, I think you have to keep doing that because that's what's going to sustain you, you know, more than the technical side will.
David, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate everything that you talked to us about today.
Great. That was fun.
Thank you for listening to The Art of the Cut with Director of Photography David Mullen, ASC. I hope you enjoyed this special edition of the podcast, and please be sure to check out The Art of the Shot for more conversations like it and many more to come.